This is Director Chris Rodriguez of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I want to welcome you to Season 2 of Intelligence Unclassified. This season, we are refocusing our episodes to better reflect NJOHSP's three core mission areas: counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. We'll be pulling both local and national experts in all these fields in an effort to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and to offer you a unique perspective on current homeland security trends and issues. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website, www.njhomelandsecurity.gov.
Hi, this is Dean Barada from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. In February of 2017, a few of us went down to the International Studies Association Conference in Baltimore, Maryland, to talk to academics and practitioners on the subject of terrorism, homeland security, and intelligence. The series of podcasts you're going to hear are our first thoughts and first observations based on listening to those presentations.
Hello, everyone. My name is Paige Schilling, and I'm an intelligence analyst with the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. Today, I'm here with Dr. Gary LaFree. Dr. LaFree is the director of the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, or START, at the University of Maryland, where he is a professor in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice. START was created to understand the human causes and consequences in terrorism and aids intelligence communities by providing research, education, and training. So in early January, you and Martha Crenshaw published a book, Countering Terrorism, No Simple Solutions. Before we discuss the book, could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you became the director of START?
Okay, be happy to. As you mentioned, my home department at the University of Maryland is in criminology and criminal justice, so my main background is in criminology. And essentially, I've spent most of my career looking or going into archival data. So I've spent a lot of time looking at archival records on homicides, robberies, other kinds of violent crimes. And back in 2000, before 9/11, one of my graduate students tipped me off about a database on terrorism that was being collected by the Pinkerton Global Intelligence Service, which is a relative of the Scottish Detective Agency that used to protect, you know, stagecoaches in the Old West. And it turns out back in the late 90s, there were about maybe 10 or 12 of these companies in the United States and in the UK. The way they would work is hire ex-military, usually intelligence officers, and for some reason, many of them were in the Air Force. And they retire from the military and then work for the private sector collecting unclassified information on terrorism. And what was especially interesting about the Pinkerton effort, though, compared to all of the others up to that point in time, is they were collecting information not only on international attacks, but on domestic attacks. And I just happened to hit their offices when they were actually shedding that part of the business. I don't think they ever probably made a lot of money on it, but, you know, Xerox is sending two people to Tanzania and they want to know how dangerous the threat of terrorism is. They could provide that information and then sell other kinds of security information. So anyway, I convinced them that people would be very interested in these data, researchers and policymakers, and we moved the data to the University of Maryland, and then 9/11 happened. And so suddenly, I had more data on terrorism than anybody else, including the government. Because of all kinds of privacy issues, the U.S. government had not collected domestic terrorist information, only international. So this was before DHS has stood up, of course, and since I'm a criminologist, I work mostly with the National Institute of Justice. So I got a grant from NIJ to try to start going through. These data were actually in shoeboxes, basically, and they had to be codified. There were about 65,000 of them. So I got some funds from the National Institute of Justice to start computerizing, digitizing the data. In the meantime, DHS got stood up. And, you know, they had lots of things on their mind, and I don't think social science was one of the first of those. But eventually they came up with this plan to set up a bunch of, they called them centers of excellence, so they'd have national competitions among university researchers for fairly targeted outcomes. And the fourth of these was on the human causes and consequences of terrorism. So using the GTD as kind of one of the main projects for that, I led an effort to get a center of excellence set up at Maryland. And after going through, I don't know, 30 or 40 applicants and five or six finalists, we succeeded and we were awarded the grant that became the START Center at the very end of 2004. And we got underway in 2005 and have been here ever since.
That's amazing. I know at OHSP we, you know, value the work that START does. We use the GTD and PIRIS and TIVIS, and you know, we're always excited when your START release is a new database for us to look at. But let's talk a little bit about your book. What was the inspiration for writing it?
Well, actually, the Global Terrorism Database was the inspiration. Essentially, as soon as we started amassing all of these data and they started piling up, I thought very early on that it would be a good topic for a book. And I actually started writing one about 7 years ago, actually. And as I got into it, as it seems like frequently happens, I realized that I wasn't writing one book, but two books. That one was a sort of technical analysis of what the data have to say about terrorism, and the other was much more of a policy piece. And so once I realized that, I thought, wow, this is an excellent time to bring in colleagues. And so for the statistical analysis, I brought in my colleagues, Laura Dugan and Aaron Miller, who've really worked the data over perhaps more than anybody else on the planet. And for the policy piece, I went to Martha Crenshaw, who's one of the leading authorities in the world, really, on the sort of operations of terrorist organizations. So we ended up finishing the statistics book first and then just finished the policy book.
The book is really focused on the characteristics of terrorism that make it difficult for governments to formulate policy. So why is creating and evaluating counterterrorism policy so difficult?
Yeah, that's a great question, and you're right. That's one of the main things we take up in the book. And I think because of several characteristics of terrorism and counterterrorism make it challenging, at least from a data point of view. For one thing, I don't think we give enough attention to the fact that it's challenging from a science standpoint because it's relatively uncommon. We've got, for the entire planet, maybe 160,000 attacks going back to 1970, which sounds like a lot, but then when you start breaking that down by country, by year, by group, it actually is not a huge amount, which means that for a lot of periods, a lot of countries, a lot of groups, there isn't much you can do in terms of statistical analysis. Even groups like Al-Qaeda, I think we have something like 60 attacks from Al-Qaeda after 9/11, so you don't have much statistical power. And I think five, you know, more recent years. So if you look at the research on terrorism, the social and behavioral science research, it's mostly limited to heavy hitters. You know, the IRA, the ETA, because they have enough attacks that you can actually look at them in a quantitative way. So that's one thing. The next thing is mass casualty attacks are even more rare. I think we count something like 7 attacks going back to 1970 that took more than 500 lives. So 9/11s are extremely rare. And this has a whole host of consequences from an analysis standpoint. For one thing, it ends up being like if you do a distribution where you looked at deaths on a sort of typical social science axis. Because, you know, most of what we do in the social sciences is based on a bell-shaped curve, a bell-shaped distribution of events. But if you plot terrorist attacks, what you see is a huge number of them on one end with 0 or 1 fatalities, and then this huge, huge tail that goes to 9/11 with 3,000. So this long tail distribution puts all kinds of limits on the analysis you can do with ordinary statistics, basically, because it's definitely not a bell-shaped distribution. So from just a pure analytic standpoint, that complicates things. It also complicates things from a policy standpoint. When you think about, you know, you're thinking about trying to stop a behavior that includes 911 on the one hand, and then cases like the Orlando bombing or the San Bernardino bombings or the Dylann Roof episode recently. I mean, they're very different, not to mention the literally thousands of cases where no one is killed in an attack that's in our database. So that actually makes it, I think, a challenge both from a data and from a policy standpoint. Then a third thing that makes it tough is, and this is especially true post 9/11, as the FBI and the government have moved to a much more of a zero tolerance for terrorism mode, they've become much more proactive at stopping terrorist attacks. So we're getting now in the United States, we have more plots than we have attacks, which, again, you don't really know where things would have gone had they hatched. I mean, obviously, we're happy that no one was killed in the incidents that are prevented. But, you know, you think about if someone had come up to you in 2000 and said, look, these guys are taking, you know, flight lessons in schools in the United States, and they're going to fly airplanes fully loaded with jet fuel into four iconic locations in the United States. I think you'd have probably thought they were drinking too much, right? I mean, it would have sounded so far-fetched. But the plots that we stop before they come to fruition, you don't really know where they would have gotten. You know, are they just a bunch of Looney Tunes, or do they have the wherewithal to really do something very damaging? So that's another issue. Another issue beyond that, I think, has to do with terrorist organizations themselves. When we think about terrorist groups, I think we tend to think of, again, the iconic movements like 9/11, like the group that was responsible for 9/11. So here you have an organized group. They have a history. They have leadership. They have communications. They have funding to some extent. They're like an entity that, you know, you could actually observe. But then there's this long, long list of other sorts of entities who actually commit terrorism, that some of them are not very well organized. Some of them are sort of loosely tied to movements, like the Timothy McVeigh case, where he clearly was influenced by right-wing ideas, but he wasn't really a major part of any particular group. Then you keep going down, and you've got the San Bernardino killings, where the woman had had some experience with sort of radicalization in the Middle East and so on, but not that much. Then you come into Orlando, and the guy had really almost no connection, except through the internet. It's a sliding scale. So our stereotype is of a kind of well-formed group, but what we're really dealing with is often much more amorphous than that. And you think about from a counterterrorism standpoint, that's critical, because what's going to work against an Al-Qaeda is probably not going to work against this sort of lone wolf attack that we've had in Orlando. So that makes it more complicated, both to study and also to design policy. And then the final thing I think that's extremely complicated about terrorism that we go over in the book is trying to figure out who did what. And I think the media really doesn't give enough attention to this as it should, that we have this sort of assumption, as soon as there's an attack, that, you know, that the government's all over it and they know immediately what's going on. And your listeners will appreciate that frequently is not the case. In our database of maybe 160,000 attacks, nearly 50% of them, we never knew who did it, basically. Even with high-profile cases, that's sometimes the case. So, like, for example, the famous Lockerbie, Scotland bombing up on the Pan Am flight. To this day, there's disagreement about how much responsibility Muammar Gaddafi had in that attack. Other people think a couple of splinter groups from Iran might have been behind it. Of course, two people were tried. One person was convicted, eventually was freed from prison for health reasons. So, you know, here's an event that there was a tremendous interest in, tremendous resources put on terms of trying to figure out what's going on. And to this day, we're still not exactly sure. So that when something comes up like the Benghazi attacks recently, I think the public sort of thinks, well, you know, we know immediately what's going on. And frequently, it may be years before we find out. And that's for the high profile. For lesser incidents, we move on. We go on to the next thing, and they're never really truly resolved. So for all those reasons, I think we have our work cut out for us, both in terms of studying terrorism and also fashioning effective responses.
Yeah, so you've just gone over quite the list of obstacles that are in the pathway to formulating policy and even recognizing and responding to terrorism. So are there any ways we can overcome these obstacles?
I think so. I really do. And I think, like, when I look at how research has developed, even since 9/11, I think we have learned a lot, basically. What we're arguing in the book is that if there's ever something that you would like to have objective information, if you'd like to have the best data possible on, it's terrorism, because it's an act that's, you know, set up to generate emotion and to generate overreaction and so on. So what does that mean in terms of where you're at? It means, I think, two things. One, you need to keep pushing as hard as you can to improve the science, to improve the data you're collecting, to improve the quality and the validity of the data you're looking at. But secondly, it also, I think, means for researchers that they need to be honest with policymakers. They need to be transparent about where the problems lie. Former Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld had this great quote about the unknown unknowns, that we need to be very forthcoming, I think, with policymakers that we provide information to about what the limitations of the data are, what we're looking at. So what does this mean? I think it means You know, we want the best intelligence we can possibly get. This is an area that the better the intelligence, the more likely you are to come up with a reasonable response and to be effective in the way you come up with it. Hard evidence is critical. At the same time, I think it's important to be transparent in the information you pass on to policymakers. You can't oversell. You want to be pretty humble in the information you're passing along because of many of the reasons we're talking about, that this is a tough area to provide first-rate objective information in.
So we spoke a little earlier about the differences between domestic and international terrorism. So do you feel the government approaches these two branches different policy-wise?
It really does. I think in some ways, the whole distinction between domestic and international is something we should probably revisit. I mean this in the sense that, first off, let's think about what it means. In the Global Terrorism Database, we essentially look at international and domestic attacks along three dimensions. So you first look at where the attack happens, the country where it happens. You then look at the nationality of the perpetrator group. And then you look at the nationality of the target. So essentially, a true domestic attack from this model would be, say, an attack in Greece against a Greek target by Greek terrorists. Anything else would be international at some level. So that's the first thing. So in other words, first off, it's complex because you get attacks on, you know, Sudanese targets in the United States by Afghanis, right? Or you get attacks on airplanes in the air from the United States to Saudi Arabia. So you get all of those things, which make it quite difficult to classify. We also remember a moment ago, we were talking about attribution. Well, remember, we only know who did it about half the time. So that means one of the crucial parts of telling whether an attack is international or not is often missing. It's missing in about half the cases. We know almost always where an attack happens. That's pretty unambiguous. But oftentimes the nationality of the target and the nationality of the perpetrators is problematic. Why revisit these notions besides the idea that they're, I think, a lot more complicated than the public thinks? The other thing about it is the internet, is the social media. We just had the Orlando case brings us up, or the case in Nice with the truck driver. These guys were not going to training camps in Afghanistan, or they weren't working closely with Al-Qaeda or ISIS, but they clearly were very well connected with the movement online. And I mentioned a moment ago Timothy McVeigh. There's this wonderful documentary out about the Oklahoma City bombings, and one of the things that really hit me while watching it is that McVeigh was a lone wolf for the most part. He had a couple of quasi-accomplices, but he was very much part of a kind of right-wing extremist movement that influenced him a great deal. So, you know, this sort of notion of what's domestic and what's international gets very fuzzy, particularly in the internet phase we're in. And it gets also fuzzy for groups like ISIS, which are international. I mean, if one of our criteria for determining whether a group's domestic or not is whether they're attacking in their own country, like imagine an attack by ISIS on an Iraqi target in Iraq. Technically, you'd say that was a domestic attack, but it's not exactly a domestic attack. Clearly, ISIS is not a domestic organization just because it happens to be attacking in Iraq. So I think, like it or not, this is an area where we have stereotypes about what that means. We get asked this question all the time on our data because people find it useful to make these distinctions. And just to go the next step, why does this matter in terms of policy? Well, think about a kind of true international attack. Let's take 9/11 as an example. Then think about a true domestic attack, and let's perhaps use the Orlando shootings as the example. Well, if you think about that from a policy standpoint, what's going to be effective against the 9/11 attackers is not going to work with Orlando. I mean, a military response, some sort of very rapid attempt to get, say, at the countries where these guys came from and so on, is not going to work with Orlando. It's much more going to depend on a kind of typical policing situation where you're getting people coming forward from the community, you're getting tips, you're getting leads. So from a policy standpoint, this domestic international thing is, I think, critically important. And I think the more technology blurs the distinction in some ways, I mean, you could ask yourself, is it possible in this period we're in to have a truly domestic attack anymore when everybody is so linked in to this international social media phenomenon.
Dr. LaFree, thank you very much for talking to us about your book. For those who are interested in purchasing the book, again, the name is Countering Terrorism, No Simple Solutions. Before we end the podcast, I'd like to delve into START and what you foresee the future of START being in 2017. I know that OHSP, as I said earlier, relies on the databases that START produces, and we're just kind of curious about what's in the works.
Oh, thanks for that. Well, I think, my goodness, one thing you can say about the threat of terrorism is it evolves very rapidly. I'm thinking back to when we began in 2005, we didn't even mention things like cyber terrorism. We didn't mention things like radicalization, believe it or not. So, you know, ISIS wasn't even on the horizon then. So things, you do have to continue to change as the threat environment changes. In terms of START's key mission, it won't change that much. I mean, we continue to try to develop a science on the human causes and consequences of terrorism. But along the way, what we're trying to do is improve the data that we're collecting and the analysis of the data we're collecting. And also, we're more and more trying to integrate different data sources together. You mentioned a moment ago TEVIS, for example, which integrates about 5 different databases that we've worked on over the years. So in terms of the things we've already been doing, we want to get better at doing them. We want to do more integration. We want to do a better job of getting our information out to policymakers, doing more training, doing more webinars, and doing more short reports that get out to policymakers. So that said, the other big change that's coming, I think, in this area, and I didn't get a chance to talk about this yet, but we talk about it in our book, is as tough as it is to study terrorism, I think it's even tougher to study counterterrorism. It's now possible to get pretty good data on terrorism, much better than say 20 years ago. But governments, you know, very jealously protect what they're doing in terms of counterterrorism. So I think where things are definitely heading is more work on trying to figure out essentially what works and what works under what circumstances. So we've got some projects along the lines that are starting to do that, but we are nowhere near as sophisticated as we can get with studying terrorism. But I mean, if you think about it, criminology is divided in the same way, that we have a lot of interest in why do people commit crime, but we also have a lot of interest in how does the system work and how successful is it and what are its strengths and weaknesses. So I think it's that strengths and weaknesses piece that START is going to be much more engaged in the future. So in terms of, you know, basic questions about, you know, what works and what doesn't work, how effective are drone strikes, how effective are military operations, targeted assassinations, diplomacy, you name it, what strategies work and under what circumstances, and we hope not just for the United States, but for all countries of the world.
Great. And we look forward to seeing that work. It's really important for policymakers and practitioners to understand the threat from terrorism and also the counterterrorism perspective. So thank you, Dr. LaFree, for taking the time to talk with OHSP today.
My pleasure.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.